M&K Talk YA now presents Strange the Dreamer, Part 1, from the Strange the Dreamer duology by Lonnie Taylor. To another episode of M&K Talk YA.
I'm Katie Bradford.
And I'm Marissa Snyder.
And this week, we started a brand new series by Lonnie Taylor, Strange the Dreamer, is the name of the first book. What's the series called? I always forget.
Ooh, does it even have a name?
I don't know. It's a duology, so this is the first book in it.
Yeah, and the second one is called Muse of Nightmares.
And for this week, we read up to chapter 32, The Space Between Nightmares.
Oh, it's just called Strange the Dreamer. That's the name of the duology.
Okay.
So, what do you think of this book so far?
I don't even know where to start. I love it.
I know.
I mean, it's great.
Ugh. I'm just completely and utterly engrossed by it.
I forgot how much I like the way she writes, even though, like, I remember that I like the way she writes, but I, like, forgot the experience of it. You know what I mean? Like, So it's just been, like, fun to read, too. And yeah, her world building is incredible.
Yeah. And her writing is like poetry. And it's, I was trying to read a little bit about her, and she said it takes her forever to write even one sentence. And I'm just like, A, you can tell because your sentences are extraordinary. And B, I was like, thank God, because otherwise she would be like a magician or a goddess or something. Like,
yeah, if it just came to her.
It makes such a difference to read a book that is really well written and beautiful. It's just, I was like texting someone about it today, and I was like, this is one of the most wonderful books I've ever read.
And I think I told you this last week, I was like nervous because I loved Daughter of Smoke and Bones so much. It's one of the few series I've actually reread. And as much as I love the way she, like, I didn't know how it would compare.
And it's so different. It's hard to compare them.
Yeah, it's so original, but yeah.
But I'm liking it just as much as I liked reading Daughter of Smoke and Bone, I would say. Like, I'm equally as into it.
I think I agree. And I don't really know what to expect, and I'm very curious to keep reading it.
And like you said, her brain just must be such an interesting place because the concepts in this book are so unique and so original and so beautiful. And like, just the concepts behind a bunch of children who are imprisoned in a citadel and like what that means, and just the whole idea of like someone being obsessed with this idea of a lost city, and like her concepts are so unique. I'm like, how did you even think about this? Like, oh, a goddess who can just obliterate memory and just swallows the name of a city so everyone forgets it. Like, who can come up with something like that?
Well, and this would be one of the things I think is kind of similar to Daughter of Smoke and Bone, but is still presented really differently, is this idea of what is a god or what is an angel versus what is a monster or a devil kind of thing. Like the power of legends and stories and how they can be presented one way but actually be the other. Kind of like, I feel like there's some kind of themes that are similar, even though the story itself is really, really different. But yeah, I don't know how she comes up with this stuff, but it's awesome.
Agreed.
And even, like, the slow reveal, like, you know, one of the main characters points of view that we see is the character Laszlo, who kind of is fascinated by Weep, the country that lost its name, so it wasn't originally called Weep, and he doesn't really know that much about it. So it's been cool to, like, it's, like, a little bit like a mystery, too. It's just been kind of fun.
Yeah, absolutely. And, like, seeing things through his eyes step by step and like everything he learns along the way, you're kind of like learning with him a little bit, which I like.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about the characters? Speaking of Mr. Yeah. Strange.
Yeah, I love his name.
Let's start with him.
Okay. So.
So he's a foundling raised in a monastery, and he has always been obsessed by this lost city of Weep. And he spent, like, his entire life studying it.
Yep. Like, that's not a thing that people study. Like, it was a personal passion, not like a... It's not like he, like, was really into chemistry and just, like, kept studying chemistry. Like, it was sort of like a... in the bottom of the library, like a bunch of fairy tale books. Like, he basically figured out and translated the language and, like, taught it to himself and spent 7 years, like, documenting all the stuff he found. And, like, no one supported him or was also looking into it or really cared about this at all, because everyone just kind of assumed it was basically a legend for a while. Made up. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's, I liked how that's why they call him Strange the Dreamer, because they almost make fun of his obsession with it and just dismiss it. And not only do they dismiss his ideas, a lot of people just are very dismissive of him growing up too. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, you're just this foundling, you know, you won't amount to anything. Why would anyone want to listen to you? Like the brothers in the monastery and even the master at the library, they kind of just brush him off as not being worth anything, and you kind of see him internalize that a little bit, but also, like, he's also able to rise above that, which I like.
Yeah. And it's interesting because a lot of when people are saying that, it's not even malicious necessarily. It's just kind of like an accepted fact of the world that, like, what I forget what the saying was that they was referenced a few times. It was like, some people do great things and some people, like, support people doing great things. And it was just kind of like, a obviously you wouldn't be the person doing the great things, you'd be the supporter of anything, you know, like, do your job well and help other people make history kind of message.
Yeah, it was like, some men do great things and some men help men do great things. Yeah. And that's funny because he's right away thrown into comparison with the golden godson, who is Theon Nero. Yeah. And he's, like, this famous alchemist who is the godson of the queen.
Who's had everything basically given to him. He's, like, on paper, everything that Laszlo is not, right?
Yep.
But how did he become an alchemist? Or how did he successfully become the first one to make gold?
Well, Laszlo gave him that information for free. I liked that setup, too, how it was, like, Laszlo comes across him being beaten by his father, essentially, because he needs him to create the secret essence that alchemists used to transmute lead into gold. There's, like, a name for it. Oh, yeah. Azoth? So, they basically say, like, we don't have any more money, the kingdom's broke, the soldiers are deserting, the enemies are noticing, and so his father, like, basically puts this on him, saying...
Which is ridiculous, yeah.
It's so ridiculous. He's 16 years old, and he's like, okay, the queen gave you this laboratory so you can become an alchemist. Like, you need to figure out how to change lead into gold and save the entire country. And, like, Laszlo sees this scene and feels bad for him, which is kind of shocking to him also, just the fact that this golden godson could be treated in such a terrible way.
Yeah, that he could relate to it so well because he's also been beaten before, but yeah.
And I love the moment when he brings Theon that book, Miracles for Breakfast.
I love the title of that book, too. I want to read it. Yeah.
And it suggests that the alchemist himself is the secret ingredient that you need. Like, you need a soul or a spirit.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's funny, too, because I feel like they could have been friends almost, right? Like, instead of being threatened by Laszlo helping him, especially because Laszlo was truly helping him, not trying to beat him to it or take his glory or anything, like, he could have used him as a resource and a friend, and instead he finds it very threatening to his, like, identity and the fact that he's the only one who knows his secret.
Mm-hmm. And I think Theon is very proud and was a little bit mortified that Laszlo, like, witnessed that scene and saw him brought so low. And I think part of him was furious that this orphan, this nothing, this person who wouldn't amount to anything, kind of saw him in that position. And so he reacts with anger. But then he also has that moment where he's like, why didn't you keep this information to yourself? Like, why didn't you try and distill it instead of giving me the answer I needed? Which is a good question. I mean, I think it's part of Laszlo, like, internalizing everyone saying, you're nothing, you will amount to nothing. And it doesn't even occur to him to, like, keep that knowledge to himself.
Well, I think it also goes back to what Laszlo is passionate about is this whole mystery of Weep and these stories. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, he cares enough to, like, want to help this boy he sees being beaten, basically, but he doesn't care about turning gold and saving the country necessarily. He cares about it on a personal level, and what he's really passionate about is Weep. And that's where he starts to have issues, is when his dream is being threatened back, basically. And I loved how they kept, or how she like phrased certain things about his dream being stolen, and just again, she just writes beautifully.
I thought that Laszlo and Theon at first, when you said they could have been friends, for some reason I thought they were going to be lovers.
I had a moment where I thought that too. I thought that it was like awkward because they had like shared, I don't know, yeah. But I don't think that, I don't see that happening at all anymore.
No. Because yeah. Theon is really not treating Laszlo well at all.
Yeah.
I mean, there was
I don't know how you get back to that point, but I agree. There was like definitely a point where I thought something, a positive relationship could have started.
Mm-hmm. And there's that moment too where Theon could have killed Laszlo. Like, he shows up and Laszlo's mm-hmm. like, oh crap, I'm the only one who knows the secret ingredient for how to be an alchemist. And he was like, he could very well kill me. And for a moment, you can see Theon is thinking about it.
Yep.
But instead, he comes back four years later and asks for all of Laszlo's books that he wrote about Weep.
Mm-hmm.
And why is that?
Because we have basically a delegation coming from Weep, which turns out was just sitting out there in the desert for 200 plus years, mm-hmm. Even though no one visited. And so I don't even know how you say his name. Errol Fane?
I think so, yeah.
Is sort of their delegation leader. He's called the God Slayer. That's mm-hmm. easier to say.
Yeah, call him that.
And he's looking for people to come help them solve a problem that they solve in the city. They say it's not a threat. Something about darkness and shadow to reference the problem. And basically he wants people to help. So he asks who's interested and he interviews them. And our buddy, the Golden Godson. It's easier. I can't pronounce any of these names. It's easy for me to refer to them by title. The Golden Godson, okay. though, gets picked, obviously. Laszlo doesn't even get an interview, but he, right before they're leaving, he basically speaks way out of turn and calls to this warrior that he's, you know, pretended to be as a small kid and, like, speaks to him in his language and just says, like, I can tell you stories. I'll do whatever I can do. I'm supposed to, like, I need to go to Weep.
And I love that moment. I love that he finally, mm-hmm. like, stood up for himself. And that's when I really started to hate Theon, because he acted like he was the one who was obsessed with this city and who had collected all this information and was like, oh, yeah, you know, I've been fascinated about you guys for so long. When really, like, he made fun of Laszlo for being so obsessed.
He didn't just steal the knowledge. He stole, like,
his dream.
Like they said, he stole the dream, right? He, like, made up his memory. He stole his memories, even, mm-hmm. like, claimed his past as his own.
I can't imagine any worse feeling than that. So I was really glad when he spoke up for himself, and the fact that Errol Fane was like, okay, yeah, you can come, we need storytellers.
Yeah, because can you imagine if he wasn't allowed to go, and he was the only one who left with them, so most of the people chosen were supposed to meet them in like 6 months, but Laszlo, he's like, here, hop on this animal. What is it called again?
God.
These animals?
Oh, here it is. I actually opened it up like right to the right page. Okay. Her name is Leeksa. So it's called Spectral.
Yeah. But basically they're like, yeah, come along. Hop on up. Grab all your stuff. He's like, I got nothing. Let's go.
Yeah, I have nothing to bring with me.
I also love how they describe his kind of transformation, because up until this point, he's been basically a scholar who's not a scholar. Mm-hmm. You know, head in a book all the time, hearing stories, reading stories, doing all this research in books and, you know, being teased for not looking at the horizon or getting out of the library. And now he's like done a 180 and he's just on this adventure and he's really come into his own.
And now he was traveling across this great desert to go to this mythical city that he spent his life dreaming about. And like, I was thinking about it because I wanted to see how long it would have, like how many miles they traveled, because I was so fascinated about this desert.
I know.
And they traveled for 6 months. Mm-hmm. Like, that is nuts.
I know. Yeah. You'd think people would go crazy.
I would. I mean, it was nice to see Laszlo, like, becoming really good friends with all the people in the caravan, like Ruza and the woman who climbed the cloud spire or whatever.
Calixte.
It was like Calixte. Yeah. I really like him kind of like meeting other people. Like, he's lived such a secluded life.
Mm-hmm.
It's nice to see him meet people and be friends with them. And like, he's such a sweetheart, you know? Yeah. Like, he could have been such a bitter person, especially from like the history that he had, but he's sweet and kind and like funny, and he's making friends really easily, and it just like made me really happy for him.
Yeah, I agree. Well, and it's also interesting because basically where he came from, it seems like a very patriarchal society again, even though they have a queen. Like, mm-hmm. there were no female scholars, and like, he yep. had never basically seen a woman before. And now, while they're still male dominated, the group has some women in it, and definitely the soldiers are like half women, and you know,
I feel that. Like
he's, yeah, it's more open-minded.
And he's not, he could have been kind of shocked by that or like had a closed mind about that. But I love the moment when it's Calixte, when she is teasing him about like, oh, if you need me to come rescue you, just scream and I'll come save you. Because like, he has no fighting experience. And there are these other women who are legit warriors. Yeah. And he's not like threatened by that or anything. He's like, yeah, I will definitely need saving. Like,
yeah, like, you do need to protect actually. Me. You're right. Yeah.
And I kind of love that about him, too. He's, like, very okay with who he is.
So should we talk about our other cast of characters?
Yes, but real quick, I did see how long or how many miles they traveled across this desert.
Oh, yeah,
so
yeah, yeah.
So I looked it up, and basically I just looked up, like, how far could a horse walk in a day? Because I figured that probably makes sense. So uh-huh. it's about 30 miles a day that they probably could have covered. So in 6 months, they probably would have traveled about 5,475 miles.
Wow.
And that's the equivalent of if you were to walk from the very tip of Maine to the bottom of Florida, down, back, and then down again.
Whoa.
So it's traveling from Maine to Florida three times over.
With nothing to even look at.
Yep. Just a desert.
Yep. They can eat you, basically.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Okay, but yes, let's talk about the other cast of characters in the City of Weep.
Okay, yeah. Basically, we know this group of kids up in this floating structure, the Citadel, who mm-hmm. are referred to as Godspawn. So they are, we learn through this first half, basically, that they are the children of the gods who were also half human by no choice of the human.
Right. Yeah. So the gods would come down to the City of Weep and steal children and basically use them for breeding.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're all half human, half god.
And they all have like a magic power, basically.
Yeah. Which is pretty cool. I like that they all have special powers. But they are the only children left because of the carnage that happened, what was it, 15 years ago?
Yep. That's the same time when the city's name vanished out of everyone's memory and every book, and no one can remember the true name of Weep anymore.
And I loved the revelation that Errol Fain was the one that slew all the gods, and he was one of the children who was captured and taken above the Citadel to serve them. And so mm-hmm. who are the remaining children who were saved during the carnage, who are stuck up in the Citadel?
Well, there's Minya, who is the youngest looking and the oldest in mm-hmm. actuality. She still looks like she's 6 years old, which is how old she was when the carnage happened. So she was the oldest at the time, and she's the one who saved the other four
babies, yeah.
And her ability, if you will, is that she can, when spirits have left their body but not completely left Earth, basically, she can, like, capture them and bind them and, like, control the spirit that's left behind.
She's such a fascinating character.
Yeah. She's a very angry character.
She's so angry. And she is the daughter of Scathus, who was the High Lord of all these gods. And it's she's such a sociopath, like how she kind of toys with the ghosts. Like, she enjoys seeing them try to fight against her will.
Mm-hmm. But I also, like, I can't imagine what she went through. Again, she's 6 years old. Everyone she knows and cares about is dead. Everyone else in the world wants to kill her. She's got four babies who don't remember anything. So they've heard the stories, but they don't feel it personally like she does. Like, I kind of get it. I'm not saying it's right, but she also, like, hasn't been exposed to anything that would really change her mind. And it was, like, a kind of a, like, can you imagine at 6 years old going through something like that?
No, having someone just murder your entire family.
And being old enough to remember it, you know, yeah. Like, I mean, right before the half that we stopped at, you see her remembering that day and the regret she has for not being able to do more.
Yeah, because she was mm-hmm. like, if I had more control over my power, maybe I could have captured the spirits of the gods and then they could have helped us.
And if my arms were bigger, I could have carried more kids. And that's what she's upset about. She's not even upset about the gods being killed. I think that's what's kind of interesting, because there's like a lot of bad guys depending on how you look at it. But really, the remaining five kids weren't bad.
No, they're completely innocent.
They didn't do anything to the humans. They're half human themselves. And the fact that they're still so hated and so blamed, that's another reason, like, of course, that's difficult to get past.
Yeah. And she's just so full of vengeance. Like, that's what she wants. She wants vengeance. And she directs that vengeance mostly against Sarai, who is called the Muse of Nightmares. And she has a really interesting gift where every night she screams moths into the world. And these moths, which is like such a crazy picture. Can you just imagine that?
That
like,
would be interesting to see on film, for sure.
Yes, for sure.
And also, what, like, it's one thing to be like, oh, she can control other people's dreams. This is another where I'm just, like, fascinated by the creativity and imagination that went into making this story. Like, what? She screams moths and she can feel everything they feel and mm-hmm. see everything. Like, that's
her consciousness.
So,
and it's, like,
cool.
It's amazing. Like, what a cool idea. And, like, she's basically the eyes of Weep now. So she sends these moths out. And Sarai is the one who kind of start seeing the perspective of humans and being mm-hmm. like, oh shit, like the gods were really monsters. Mm-hmm. Like when she starts to see what the humans endured at their hands. And Minya keeps wanting to turn her into a weapon. And so Minya sends her out to give all the humans nightmares and to just torment them. And it's kind of funny too that Sarai's mother was, what was her name? Isagul, the goddess mm-hmm. of despair. And her father was the God Slayer.
Yeah. Oof. And again, though, I feel like it's one thing to kill the gods who were torturing them. It's another that they killed all these other babies and stuff. Although,
yeah,
I'm very curious, like, were there still the six gods and then all these kids over 200 years? What happened to the rest of them? Or were they all living on the Citadel and also killed? Or did they, you know, like, what happened between the nursery and gods?
Yeah. Well, that was my question, too, because Minya says the reason she didn't expose her power was because once the god spawn babies are tested for their powers, like, once their powers manifest, they're taken away. So one of my questions was, where are they taken?
Yeah, what do they do?
I have no idea.
Are they, like, yeah. Because you think if you're bothering to produce so many, like, I'm curious what the gods were trying to do by breeding so much. And, like, you know, like, I feel like there had to be some kind of motive to it, almost.
Yeah, some kind of purpose. And, like, why can't they reproduce just with themselves? Like, why do they yeah. need humans to do that? So I think Sarai has a really unique perspective because she is one of the first people to see the gods actually as monsters and to realize that the gods did terrible things and the humans rose up for a reason. It wasn't like they were just attacking yeah. the gods to be malicious.
Yeah, they were partially justified yeah. at least in killing
the gods. Parents. Yeah. And then we have some other children too. We have Feral, who is the only boy.
Yep, the cloud thief.
The cloud thief, yeah. And then we have Ruby, who can conjure fire.
Yep.
And they call her Bonfire.
She's got a lot of spunk.
Yeah, I like how her superpower is fire, but instead of that manifesting as, like, destruction, it's passion. Like, she's the most passionate mm-hmm. out of all of them.
Yeah, I agree.
And then there's Sparrow, who is the Orchid Witch, and she can make things grow. And it took me a really long time to realize that these children were trapped in the Citadel. Like, they can't go anywhere because the Citadel is made of Mesarthim, this kind of metal that only the High Lord Scathis could control. And, like, Minya's upset because she didn't inherit her father's power. So, essentially, they are trapped in the Citadel, and they're, like, running out of food. Basically, they know they think that their only end is to wait for the humans to discover them and kill them.
Yeah, the one rule that they live by is don't let anyone know we're alive, basically.
Yep. And just, like, I think that the author did a good job of conveying that, like, frustration of, like, they're a bunch of, like, 15, 16-year-olds who are trapped
in this. Nothing to read.
Closed up
no
space.
No interesting food to eat.
There's one boy and, like, four girls. And
who are all hitting their 16, 17
hormones.
Ages.
Yeah. And they're just kind of like, oh, what are we going to do? Like, I think it's just an interesting mixture of, like, boredom, curiosity, like, wanting something to change, and just being frustrated that it can't.
Yeah, and just having no control over their lives.
Yeah. But then...
So, yeah.
There's so much to this first half of the book. Oh, my God.
There is. There's just a lot going on.
Okay, so then the God Slayer arrives with his caravan back in Weep. And Sarai goes to give the God Slayer a bunch of nightmares. And instead, in his bed, she finds Laszlo.
Mm-hmm.
I love that scene. I love when she sees Laszlo for the first time and she goes into his dreams and she sees this vision that he has of Weep where it's beautiful. Like, there's no citadel blocking out the sky. It's like this perfect fantasy, and she's, like, completely mesmerized by his vision and his version of her city.
And usually when she goes into people's dreams, she can manipulate them, but she can't interact with the person dreaming. And Laszlo looks right at her.
Yeah, and he sees her. And she's petrified by that because she's like, oh, God.
And intrigued.
Someone saw me.
Yeah. I feel like she has very mixed emotions about it. In part because she thinks everyone there is coming to kill her, to be fair.
Yeah.
But, yeah. And Laszlo eventually sees a painting of the gods and realizes that he saw one in his dream without any spark to make him... Like, it's not like he saw the picture and then dreamt it.
Right. He dreamt about her before he knew she existed.
Yeah. So I really hope that they start interacting via his dreams to some extent and save the whole world. That's my prediction.
And fall in love. I feel like that's what's going to happen. It's going to be like... It's going to be kind of like a little bit of Daughter and Smoke and Bone. Like, you can totally see parallels between that book and this one because it's like... Sarai is going to fall in love with a human who's going to be Laszlo, and there's going to be this whole thing where she falls in love with the race that killed her family. And not that I mind any of that. Like, I think that I can't wait for that to happen, but I just, it's kind of similar to, like, the angels and the Chimera. And, like, two sides of rivals come together. Yeah.
Yeah, it's there's some good themes, but it's still, the characters feel really different, even if they're following similar paths. And the world building, that's why it took half a book. Like, because really when you think about it, even though we just talked about a lot of things, we're sort of just getting the part where these two different things are interacting at all. Everything else is kind of like background information or like building the characters, building the world, building the legends out. So I love her. I want to live in her. I want to go and jump into her dreams and see what an interesting place it is.
Agreed. Yeah, I wish I had Sarai's power to go do that. But I also like how she built up the suspense so much, and now it's coming to a head where Sarai visits the other members of the delegation, and she sees that they actually have flying machines.
Yeah.
And they could now storm the Citadel and kill them. And that's really upsetting to her, obviously. So when she goes back and tells the other children, some of them are terrified, but Minya is the one who's, like, almost excited about it.
Well, she's ready to get her vengeance.
Yeah, and then she reveals that she has kept the souls of every single human that has ever died in Weep in that, like, heart of the Citadel. And so she's collected basically an army of undead humans and she wants to turn them against their own kind and fight so that the humans don't come up and kill them.
Well, and these are going to be the people, these humans, to get through, like, a barrier of these ghosts, like, soul, spirits, whatever they are. Those are, like, their friends and family. Like, it's not just random humans. It's, like, people they knew from their town, you know? Like, yeah.
So that's the plan. That's Minya's plan. And I'm kind of worried to see how it turns out.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, things, even though we just talked about predicting kind of a happy ending at the end of the day, it's not going to be an easy path. They're not going to get it right on the first try. Some stuff is really going to go down first.
And I still have so many questions. Like, why did the gods even show up in that city?
Well, I want to hear more about the demons who were supposedly killed by the gods the first time, and that's what the skeletons are.
Right.
Like, I want to hear more about that, too.
And how they, like, anchored the citadel, and they targeted places so specifically. Like, they destroyed the university, the royal palace, and the library, so they completely cut off the humans from, like, knowledge and their rulers so that they could conquer them.
And I even want to hear more about why Weep kept themselves so separate before this
happened.
Oh,
before they came, yeah.
Because, you know, before they came, they would caravan over, but, you know, the legend at least was that if any outsider came, they'd be killed. Even if an outsider tried to come, they probably wouldn't make it, but even if they made it there, they'd be killed because... Like, why were they so against having outsiders there? And then it's interesting that given they were so against having outsiders there, they're the ones who had these basically, like, alien life forms come down and, you know,
take them
it's
over.
Just, I'm kind of curious about the world outside of this as well, or how they interact with the...
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm curious too. And I also really want to learn more about, like, there's just so many good relationships too, like Errol Fain and his second in command, Azarine. And like, their whole love story, how they knew that one of them was probably going to get taken at a certain point, so they married young.
So they could be with each other first. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And they had 5 days together.
Mm-hmm.
And then Errol Fain, his story is so fascinating, because he gets taken, and he's held the longest. He's held for 3 years. And normally, when a child's taken, they are returned, but their memories are completely gone. So they have no recollection of what happened to them when they were up with the gods. Mm-hmm. And that's, in a way, a little bit of a mercy, because what happens to them is obviously terrible. Mm-hmm. But since he's the god slayer who orchestrated the whole overthrow, there was no goddess left to erase his memory. So he's left with all those memories. And you can see him really struggling with it.
And he's not the only one, right? Anyone who was up there... Basically, anyone who didn't get returned voluntarily by the gods with their memories wiped still has their memories. His problem is probably that he has the most memories that should have been erased in part. And I think his situation was also unique, because they talked about how, well, at least from the surviving god spawn, most of them were fathered by a god, not mothered by a god.
Mm-hmm.
Or something. I don't know. There seems like there's more of a backstory for why was he taking the longest, or what was his relationship like.
Yeah, because he describes that moment where he's like, he remembers Isagul, the goddess he was paired with, and he is like filled with disgust but also desire.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just kind of curious, like, did he love her in a way? Like, what was their relationship? I mean, he was taken by force, which... You'd think, how could you ever love someone that way? But then again, I don't know. Like, does your brain start to make you love them as, like, a way of self-defense? You know?
Yeah.
So he feels, like, weak for having loved her and feels disgusted with himself. But I think, in a way, there was more to their relationship than what meets the eye.
Yeah. Well, and I feel so bad for these kids, too.
Yeah.
Because, again, they're, like, 15, 16, 17 years old, something like that. And... They're talking about how, like, coming to terms with the fact that their mothers didn't want them or would kill them if they found them. And some of that is probably in part because their memories are stolen, too. Like, I would think even if they were conceived in a terrible way, if they could remember, like, having a kid... You know, like, some people still form that attachment to the child. I mean, I don't know.
Sure, that's
true. It's just, like, it's interesting. Like, all they have are the... I'm curious to see if any of them end up making a connection with a human who they're related to at some point down the road.
Yeah. And I think that most of the Godspawn too are kind of coming to this realization that their parents were monsters in a way too, because they're all told about their horrible conception stories and they're like, oh, that's such a horrible thing to have to learn as a child.
Yeah, I feel like they're angry at being hated and outcast, and maybe that the other kids were killed, but I don't feel like there's a ton of anger about the gods being killed anymore. Mm-hmm. Especially because they have no memory of them. They sort of understand that they were bad people. Like, even...
except for Minya, who just, like, wants vengeance.
Yeah. She's angry. She's really angry.
I also wonder why does she still look like she's 6 years old, and why hasn't she grown up beyond that? I wonder, like, if that trauma of witnessing the carnage kind of, like, arrested her growth and, like, stopped her in her tracks. I'm curious to learn more about that.
Mm-hmm.
Did you do any research this week?
I did a little bit on lost cities.
Ooh, fun.
So I looked up some lost cities that have been found and some lost cities that haven't been found. Which are you more interested in?
Ones that haven't been found, because then we'll go look for them. We'll quit our jobs. Cross the desert.
You've probably heard of some of these stories. I'm not going to talk about, like, Atlantis or anything like that. But I thought this one was interesting. So, The Lost Land of Lioness.
Mm.
It's from the story of Tristan and Isolde.
Oh, yeah, I know that story.
Like, the Arthurian legend.
Mm-hmm.
And legend goes that it sunk into the sea, but it also is known... basically, there's, like, enough reference in it that people think that it was a real city, not just a legendary location. So even though, like, the Arthurian legends are considered legends, there's, like, some indication they think that this city specifically existed at one point. Hmm. So prior to its sinking, this city was supposedly contained 140 villages and churches.
Wow.
And it supposedly disappeared on November 11th, 1099.
How did it disappear?
So I guess very suddenly the land was flooded by the sea and entire villages were swallowed and everyone in the area drowned.
Whoa.
And once it was covered with water, it never came back out again. So they think it was attached to the Scilly Islands in Cornwall, England, like people who believe it really existed. And there's scientific evidence that shows that the sea levels were lower in the past than they are now. So it's feasible that part of the area that's now below sea level would have been land back in the day. And there's fishermen in this area that say that they've, you know, found pieces of buildings and other structural things in their fishing nets a lot. So, yeah, but it's never been found, so they're not sure that it actually really existed, but...
And have there been people who, like, tried to look for it?
I believe so. That's kind of the impression I get, but I don't know if anyone, like, super academically minded went to go find it or anything like that.
I hope there's a Laszlo out there who's been dreaming about it and will one day find it.
I know. And then there's the lost desert cities of Dubai.
Oh.
Which kind of reminded me of this a little bit, mm-hmm. So... one of the most famous lost cities of Arabia is the medieval city of Julfar, which is where Sinbad the Sailor, the fictional character, was supposed to be from, but also a lot of other people. So 1,000 years before falling into ruin and disappearing from human memory, it was like a thriving place. It was a port city, and it was the hub of the Southern Gulf Arabic trade in the Middle Ages. Wow. So it's thought to be somewhere on the Persian Gulf coast north of Dubai.
And do they know what happened to it?
I don't know if they know what happened to it, but so there's signs of settlement found on the site, or found, so I guess they did find a site for this at some point in the 1960s or something like that. But signs of settlement date back as far as the 6th century, and like trade was bustling in this area at the time, but the 10th to 14th century is when this was really like a legit city that you'd want to check out, I guess. And like at its height, they think it had 70,000 people there.
Wow.
And basically it just kind of fell into ruin as different groups of people took over the area and it got buried by sand, and kind of people forgot it existed basically for a long time until they eventually kind of stumbled across it again, I guess.
That's just nuts, because like, how does 70,000 people just disappear? Like, where did they go? Did they just slowly leave the city and then it became like a ghost town and then was buried?
Yeah, I guess that one made it sound more like it was a slower decline, but it went from being like a very, very real bustling happening port city to like no one even remembered it existed, which is crazy.
Whoa, that's so cool and scary. Will you tell me about two cities that were found now?
Okay. So, I like the ones where things go underwater. I don't know why.
That's believable.
You know the mythical Atlantis. There is a real city called Helike, H-E-L-I-K-E, that was also part of Greek myth and was said to have been destroyed by the wrath of the god Poseidon. Basically, according to legend, the whole city went underwater in a single night. So it was supposedly destroyed around 373 BC. And for centuries, people thought it was just a story. But then in the late 1980s, two archaeologists started a quest to try and find it. And it took them more than a decade of work. And they eventually found that it had been buried under the earth. Yeah, so the disaster that destroyed it, according to the team, wasn't necessarily an act of Poseidon, but it would have felt like one to people at the time. They said there was an earthquake that liquefied the ground, turning the earth beneath the feet their feet into water as the whole city collapsed into an inland lagoon formed by the tremor. God. Isn't that crazy?
Like a giant sinkhole.
Yeah, that just appeared one day. I mean, like, you know, there was an earthquake and then it formed a giant sinkhole.
That's terrifying.
And the whole city vanished. And I love, this is, again, these two archaeologists back in, like, the 80s were like, let's go find this city.
And then they did. Can you imagine that day that they found it, how excited they would be?
So excited.
Like, after a decade of, like, dedicating your life to finding this city, and people probably are calling you crazy.
I know. They're like, that's just a myth.
Why are you wasting your time?
That's a Greek myth. Yeah, Poseidon didn't bear anything.
Oh,
yeah.
And they find it. I love that. I love that so much.
So I guess the two stories that I kept reading were about cities that went under water or cities that were buried in sand. So there is a city called Leptis Magna, and it's supposedly where the Roman emperor Septimus Severus was born, and he turned it into like a huge city, and it was like, you know, kind of a central place in his empire. But when Rome started to fall, it also started to fall, so it was pillaged by different groups of people and destroyed by invaders and kind of completely forgotten again until the 19th century archaeologists found it. So it was 1,200 years, or it was buried under sand dunes, but it was perfectly preserved under those sand dunes. So it wasn't like they just found some pots. They found like a whole ancient Roman city buried in the sand. So it still had an amphitheater, baths, a basilica, a circus, and all preserved to look how the city probably would have looked in its prime. So, it's just kind of, it's just cool.
That's
to
incredible.
Think about. Yeah.
Did they, and can people now go and visit it?
I would think so. I guess I didn't actually read about visiting it, but
that'd be
I
cool.
Think so.
That's fascinating that it was just preserved perfectly. Like, what a great, you could just learn so much from that. You know, it takes a lot of the guesswork out.
Well, and it's so interesting too to think, I mean, like, it kind of goes back to what Laszlo did, right? You know, there's some, he talked about the breadcrumbs on someone's beard. There's like some kernels of truth in every legend. And I think it's funny to hear about the stories that people never found or hear about the stories of cities that were found eventually. It's like, in either case, there was some basic story and at some point or another, people believed it enough to look for it. Like whether it was El Dorado or the city of Z that they, you know, never found but were looking for. There's also this question of, well, where did the legend come from in the first place? Or, you know, to what extent?
There has to be some truth to it.
Yeah. So that was my research. It was fun, though.
I loved that.
What did you look into?
Well, I struggled a little bit because everything just seemed so epic. And I don't know. I was like, what research could I do that's, like, even worthy of this? So my research is kind of dumb, but I was really fascinated by the god spawn being trapped in that citadel, and just like little things like when they ran out of flour and sugar and like they baked their last birthday cake and they knew that they couldn't, that they would never taste cake again.
That was sad. Yeah.
Yeah, and just like the mentality of being trapped in a place and like thinking that your only way out is death, which is just so horrifying. So I just started researching examples of people getting trapped in weird places.
Love it.
So all of these have happy endings, don't worry. It doesn't end with like a bunch of gods coming and killing them. So there was a man who was trapped in an elevator for 41 hours.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Did people not know he was there, or they just couldn't get to him, or what?
I will tell you. So in 1999, Nicholas White was working at the McGraw-Hill building in New York City, and he went to have a cigarette break. And then he headed back up to his 43rd floor office, and he took the elevator. And then the elevator just stopped for no reason. He hit the alarm and waited. Nothing. So he's basically like in a 6x6 box, and there was no elevator emergency phone. He didn't have a cell phone. And he at first he didn't panic. He was just like, okay, like someone's
this
like
is annoying. Yeah.
Yeah. But then no one came. And so he started to get desperate. So he started like trying to pry the door open. But he was in the middle, like it was in the middle of the floor. So it was just like a solid concrete wall. So he just had to wait there. And then he waited for the rest of the afternoon into the night, then overnight, then all day the next day. And he was stuck in there for 41 hours. And it was on the 13th floor, which is just ironic.
Oh my goodness. Of course it was. I thought buildings didn't have a 13th floor, technically.
I think hotels don't.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
This is where it gets really, it's just terrible because there was a security camera. So he was on camera the entire time, but none of the security guards were paying close enough attention to the videos to notice that there was a guy trying to escape this elevator for 2 days. And 5 different shifts went by, and he was trapped in plain sight, and nobody noticed until finally someone saw him sleeping on the floor of the elevators, and the security guard thought that a homeless person had broken into the building, and he buzzed into the elevator and started talking to him, and this poor guy was there for 48 hours. He probably thought he was, like, hallucinating.
Yeah.
And so they finally like got the elevator working again. First of all, like, how did you not even notice that the elevator was broken? Like,
how many elevators were in this building, do you know?
I don't know, but
I guess more than one, because someone would have complained.
So he finally got out and he sued them, and basically nothing happened of the case. He settled for like a very small sum. But basically, like, he didn't really get any restitution for this horrible ordeal that could have been easily prevented.
Did work not even notice that he didn't come back or whatever?
That's the thing. Like, someone would notice, right?
I would be so pissed if I disappeared.
Oh, my God. Me too.
Yeah.
I'd be pissed if I was on camera because, I didn't watch it, but there's also a YouTube video that has all of the camera footage.
Oh, my goodness.
So you can see everything this poor man did for 41 hours.
I don't think I'd want that on YouTube.
I know.
That's crazy, though. Oh, my goodness. I would be, like, losing my mind in 5 minutes. Yeah. That's why you should always bring a book in your purse.
Yeah.
That's what I've learned from this.
I usually do. In fact, if I don't, I get, like, antsy. I get, like, oh, my God, I don't have a book with me.
My mom, not, like, got mad, but the other day I came over for dinner, and we had, like, my aunt, my uncle, my cousin were over, too, and I, like, brought my book in with me just because I always bring it with me whenever I'm reading. And she was like, do you think we're going to be that boring? I'm like, no, because I have it, I won't need it. If I didn't bring it, then you probably would be boring or something would happen or I don't know.
Okay, so this next story, you're going to really wish that this person had a book. Because there was a French woman who was 69 years old, and she was in her house, and she was using the bathroom, and then found that her door lock was broken. And she was trapped in her bathroom for 3 weeks.
Oh my goodness. 3 weeks?
3 weeks.
She
survived off of water.
Okay. Oh,
but
okay,
I don't know what she did for food. And she was 69 years old. Like,
So was there no, was it on, what floor was she on?
I don't know. It doesn't say. So she, it says that she tried to alert neighbors to her, to what had happened, and she was banging against the pipes at night. And the neighbors were just annoyed by it. And they started, they got together a petition to, because they thought it was construction that was happening at night. So they got together and signed a petition to have the apartment complex end the late night construction that was keeping them away.
So who eventually found her?
They said someone finally caught on when they noticed the woman's absence in a stack of gathering mail. So firefighters broke through and freed the woman from her apartment. She'd been trapped for 20 days.
Oh my goodness.
So nuts. And how did she not have, she didn't have children to like check up on her?
Well, yeah.
I feel like 3 weeks is a long time to not have anyone check up on you.
No, that is a long time. But I mean, again, someone could have like checked up and not checked, you know, like, I don't know. Well, I guess, but how long do you go before you like really haven't heard? Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I could see like calling my mom and being like, oh, she didn't pick up. She must be out. But then not for 21 days.
Right. So this last one, there was a 91-year-old French woman. So this is all happening in France. I don't know what's going on in France.
Bring a buddy everywhere in France. That's what
for real.
Or a book, at least.
So she had to run an errand to the bank, and she needed access to her, I don't know, vault or whatever, her safety deposit box. So the standard practice is you let an employee lets you into your bank vault and they lock you in it, which is like just protocol.
Okay.
But then this employee locked this 91-year-old woman in the vault and forgot about her. Oh my God, that's not funny. They left her in there and turned out the lights, completely forgot about her.
For how long?
They got her out the next morning at 10 a.m.
Oh, okay. But still.
And it was because her son tried calling her and she didn't pick up and freaked out. And he called the authorities. And so, could you imagine being that employee and realizing what you did?
I feel like if I were that bank employee, even if I really did that in the moment, I feel like at some point that weekend, I would have, like, woken up in the middle of the night and been like, oh my goodness, did I ever let her out or something?
I would never be okay again.
Oh my goodness. At least this old lady has someone who cares about her. Even the guy in the elevator, no one was, like, looking for him. This makes me more sad than anything.
That kind of reminds me, my coworker and I were just laughing with our boss, and we were like, if we didn't come into work, Joe, would you be worried? And he was like, what do you mean? And I was like, how long would it take for us to not show up at work for like you to be worried? And he was like, 2 weeks. And we're like, oh, thanks.
Well, because when you think about it, even if someone, usually like you at least text or something. Yeah, I wonder how long would I wait and get concerned? Or like, you know, because we don't even live in the same place. Like if I texted you about podcast and you didn't respond, I would probably just assume you were busy for, you know, a little bit. But then at what point would I be like...
Probably because we'd have like a recording session scheduled and I'd skip it and then you'd be
nervous.
That's true.
Or if I texted you enough and like if I kept telling you news about some new series and you didn't feel the need to comment, I'd probably get worried.
That would be alarming. I have had an experience where Chad has gone out at night and has not come back until the following morning. But I always know that when he does that, like, I know the friend that he's always with, and I, like, kind of know to expect it. So, like, if I wake up and he's not there in the morning, I'm like, okay, well, he's still with his buddy, and I know he's fine. But that, I think that...
I would still want, like, a text or something.
That's still a little much,
yeah.
Yeah. It goes to show how much I trust this friend. I'm, like, not even concerned when it's, like, 9 o'clock in the morning and he hasn't come home. Oh, God. Oh,
I was, like, dating someone, and he was at a work thing. But his birthday was, like, the next day. So we were going to, like, meet up at midnight because I'm, like, really into birthdays. And he didn't show up and he didn't answer his phone. And I was like, okay, whatever. I was just annoyed at first.
Ooh.
And then I was like, wait, why haven't I heard anything? Like, he should have at least said, like, I'm running late or I'm not going to make it. And then I, like, started really panicking. But then he just, like, stayed at a hotel for a work thing and his phone died or something. But I was, like, so mad at that point. I was, like, starting to freak out. Like, I didn't care that you didn't come. I cared that I had no idea where you were.
And I was terrified.
Yeah.
That happened to me at work. I used to work at this restaurant, and I got locked in the freezer by accident.
Oh, man.
Yeah. And it was, like, one of those things where the freezer was inside the dry goods room. So it was, like, a room within a room. And this is nutso. So I didn't get locked in, but you know how, like, when you slam freezers shut, it forms that seal?
Yeah.
So that's what happened. I didn't have my cell phone on me because we weren't allowed to have cell phones on the floor. And I was in a meat freezer. So it was really cold.
Yeah.
And I couldn't open the door. And I was banging on the door as hard as I could and screaming as loud as I could. Like, as loud as I could possibly scream. Trying to get someone to, realize where I was. And nobody came. And finally, like, the seal broke, obviously, and I was able to get out. But I was gone. I was probably only in there for, like, maybe 4 minutes or so. So, like, not a long time. But
that's a long time if you're inadequately dressed for cold weather, too.
But also, like, I was talking to my employees, and I was like, I was in the freezer. Did nobody hear me? And they were like, we didn't hear a thing. And I had been, like, screaming at the top of my lungs.
That is
That's
creepy.
What was the that's most scary. Disturbing thing. Yeah, I know.
We locked ourselves out of our house the other day. Did I tell you that story?
Oh, no.
Which I wouldn't have really cared that much. I mean, I would have cared, but it wouldn't have been that. We were celebrating my birthday. And as I just said, I love birthdays. This is really annoying. We had just been out to dinner and our garage door opener stopped working. So we had that door unlocked, but we had taken, I have a house key on my car key set, but James, I guess, hadn't grabbed his house key. He just had his car key because he always can get through the garage. And then we realized, like, Toby was in there. So, like, because we were just going to go to my mom's place or something, but we, like, had to get Toby out, obviously. So we ended up having to call a locksmith. And we hadn't gotten a spare, because we hadn't even gotten a spare key yet because we just moved into a new house and we want to get everything rekeyed anyways. But we just, like, hadn't done it yet. And so, yeah, it was really annoying.
That's scary.
Yeah. But if someone didn't notice, I would be very upset at everyone who should have noticed.
I would notice. I would. I would call the authorities.
Should we do like a daily check-in? Like, I'm should not we? Locked up anywhere today.
I'm not trapped in an elevator. I'm just fine.
Going I guess off the that grid. Would be one time I would prefer a Kindle. If I were locked in an elevator for 40 hours, I hope that I have my Kindle and not a physical book.
Then you wouldn't panic at all. You're just like, this is a nice reading retreat.
Yeah, this is perfect. Then someone would be like, it was open, you just didn't try the door or something. I'd be like, oh, whoops.
Okay. Well, do you have a joke for me this week?
I do.
Okay.
How do you get a farm girl to like you?
Oh. I don't know.
A tractor.
I really get like it? That. I was going to say something like, have a tractor that's sexy. I don't know. That's good.
I thought about telling a chemistry joke, but it had no reaction. That was a good one. I was trying to look up an alchemy joke, but I didn't find one. So that was the closest I got.
Oh, I like it. All okay, right. Should we keep reading?
Yes, let's finish this book for next week.
I cannot wait. If you guys want to get in touch with us, you can email us at mnktalkya@gmail.com, or we're also on Instagram and Facebook at mnktalkya.
Bye, bookworms.
Go get a library card.
M&K Talk YA is produced and edited by Marissa Snyder and Katie Bradford. Original music composition by Timothy Milkey. Logo design by Marissa Snyder. For updates and extras, visit mnktalkya.com or follow us on Instagram and Facebook. And if you haven't already, please rate, review, and subscribe on iTunes. We would like to thank James Tobias, Chad Snyder, Meredith Kelfie, and Michael Howard for all of their support. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.